Did you hear the knock?
Yes. My father went to the door. Then we heard shots. And I started screaming.
One bullet hit him in the face. Another bullet hit him in the chest.
All I could see was my dad laying there. That was horrific. That's a vision you'd never forget.
They asked for him by name, and he was immediately shot. They would come to the door specifically to kill Sal.
I heard four gunshots, and I came running out. I seen two guys running away.
Nobody knew who they were. This was a whodunit.
He started getting threatening phone calls. And they said they wanted to go for a ride. This sounded like something out of The Godfather.
You're climbing a ladder here, one rung at a time, to try to get to the top.
There's that old saying, if you want to kill the snake, you cut off the head.
Was there any doubt in your mind this was a contract killing?
This was a cold-blooded murder of a man in the doorway of his home in front of his family. It just doesn't get much worse than that.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, and tonight we're on the case in Encinitas, California, a half hour north of San Diego. It was here on the quiet streets of this affluent suburb that a loving father was gunned down in his own home. The brazen crime stunned the community and left his heartbroken family grasping for answers. September 17th, 1988. It was just past 8 on a beautiful California night when police got a frantic call from Barbara Rossetti. She told the dispatcher that her 58-year-old husband, Sal, had just been ambushed by a gun-wielding attacker in the doorway of their home. Within minutes, first responders arrived at the chaotic scene.
What did officers discover?
Sal was on his back. He was bleeding profusely. One bullet hit him in the face. Another bullet hit him in the chest.
Sadly, there was nothing emergency workers could do to save his life.
Was Sal declared dead at the scene?
He was. He had certainly expired by the time the police arrived.
Detectives quickly determined there had been two witnesses to the crime, Sal's wife and his youngest daughter, Gina. The two women told police about Sal's last moments alive.
What was your family doing that night?
We were watching television. My niece was upstairs. She was playing on the computer. My dad was playing with my nephew in the living room.
Although Gina was legally blind, officers believed her account of the savage attack would be critical. She said that the nightmare began with a knock at the front door.
Would it have been unusual for anybody to knock on the door that late at night?
Yes.
Gina told investigators she had been curious, so she listened in on the conversation between her mother and the two men at the door.
What did you hear?
One man asked for Sal. I said, should I go get him? My mother said yes, and I went and got my father.
Gina assumed that they knew her father, since they had asked for Sal by name.
What happened next?
My father went to the door. And then we heard shots.
Gina was instantly paralyzed with fear.
My feet were like in cement. I could not move.
Despite her impaired vision, Gina was aware of what was happening. was there any doubt in your mind that shots had just been fired from a gun?
No, it had to be that. My mother began screaming, and then I started screaming.
Were you terrified that you would be hit?
I didn't really think of that at the moment. I was just thinking about my father.
As police studied the front room of the house, they realized just how lucky the young woman had been.
One of the bullets missed my head by 2 inches.
Investigators took Gina and her young niece and nephew to safety and sealed off the home for processing. Moments later, Sal's older daughter, Lisa, the mother of the two young children, arrived at the surreal scene. The 29-year-old had been at work when her mother informed her about the attack.
Did your mother give you any details?
No.
She said somebody just came in and shot Daddy.
I was like, oh, I'm sorry.
Lisa also didn't know if her children had been hurt.
All you knew was your father had been shot.
Yes. I was in shock. I was absolutely in shock.
What did the scene look like?
There was a big crowd, and the big boom trucks were out there with the lights and, you know, reporters. There was cops everywhere. The cops were like, you can't go in. It's an active crime scene. And I said, my whole life is in that house. My children, my parents, my sister, my whole life was in that house.
But Lisa was certain that life would never be the same.
All I could see was my dad. That was horrific. That's a vision you'd never forget.
As Sal's loved ones struggled to comprehend their loss, investigators had reached a disturbing conclusion. Sal Russetti had been the victim of an execution-style murder.
The immediate thought was that whoever had come to the door had come to the door specifically to kill Sal. They asked for him by name. He was immediately shot.
Russetti had been shot and killed in a flurry of gunfire while standing in the doorway of his own home. Now, as the San Diego County Sheriff's Department investigated the shocking crime, Sal's loved ones were still trying to comprehend the nightmare that unfolded in front of their eyes. ...58-year-old Sal Russetti had been a loving father and doting grandfather who devoted his life to his family.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Daddy.
Sal and his wife, Barbara, had been happily married for 37 years. The couple had 4 grown children and 5 grandchildren. Now the Russetti clan was struggling to envision a life without its patriarch.
You were just 23 years old when you lost your father. How did you deal with your grief?
I was just so devastated. It's difficult to describe that feeling when you know that person is gone. It was so hard. I just couldn't stop crying.
We were all treading water. It's like, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do?
Sal had grown up in Milwaukee, but moved his family to the San Diego area so that Gina could attend a special school for the blind.
He moved your family from Wisconsin to California to make sure you got the education you deserved.
That's correct, yes. He was very protective of me. I've always had a problem with self-esteem, and he would tell me every day how beautiful I was. We were very, very close.
Sal's second greatest love was his career. He dedicated himself to becoming one of Southern California's most successful car salesmen.
He was very hardworking. His whole life, he was hardworking. He was not going to go out there and be mediocre.
Sal had a well-earned reputation for honesty and integrity.
Did he like his work?
He loved it. I can't tell you the awards that he's won. He was such a people person.
He was a really good car salesman. He was well-liked. People respected him.
Still, investigators on the case were certain that there was someone out there who wanted Sal Rossetti dead.
This was a premeditated, cold-blooded murder of a man in the doorway of his home in front of his family. It just doesn't get much worse than that.
Detectives quickly went to work, analyzing the evidence collected at the crime scene.
Could officers determine what kind of weapon was used?
They gathered four shell casings from a 9mm firearm. They were able to pull out two slugs from inside the foyer that had been embedded in the walls. They were missed shots.
Police then sat down with Sal's wife, Barbara, who had seen the two strangers when she answered the door that night. Barbara said one of them was of average height with a bushy mustache and had been wearing a very unusual belt buckle made out of blue stone.
30 years old, 170 pounds, wearing dark clothing.
The other man was slightly taller and thinner.
150 pounds, with long hair to the shoulders, wearing a beige baseball-type hat, a light-colored jacket, and dark trousers.
Barbara was confident that both men were Hispanic.
Mrs. Rossetti heard them speak in Spanish, and what they heard him say was SAS.
The translation, that's him, followed by gunshots, erased any lingering doubts that the two men had come for the sole purpose of killing Sal. Barbara explained that the tragedy was just seconds away from becoming even worse.
If it had been 1 minute earlier, my husband was holding the baby. And I wonder what would have happened then.
It's a thought that still keeps the three-year-old's mother, Lisa Rossetti, up at night.
How often have you relived that scene?
When you saw where the bullet holes went all over the place, he could have been hit just being in the other room because the bullet holes had gone through two rooms.
Police canvassed the area and quickly found several witnesses who actually saw Sal's killers race away from the crime scene.
I heard four gunshots, and I came running out. I seen two guys running away.
Could the neighbors provide any details about the getaway car?
One neighbor believed it was a Toyota, and two neighbors said it was a rust-colored vehicle.
How difficult did investigators think this case was going to be to solve?
They had very little to go on. They had a sketchy description of the getaway car. They had a pretty sketchy description of the two suspects.
Nobody knew who they were. This was a whodunit.
Police working to solve the ruthless murder of Sal Rossetti had almost nothing to go on. Their best tip had come from Sal's wife, Barbara, who stood face to face with the attackers just seconds before the shooting. But even her description of the men did little to advance the investigation. And as the hours rolled by without a new lead, investigators feared that the cold-blooded killers were getting further away from justice. The brazen execution-style slaying of Sal Rossetti created a wave of fear in the beachfront town of Encinitas, California.
How did the community react to Sal's murder?
This murder occurred about a mile from where I lived with my family at the time. The brutal nature of just this hardworking American family man just gunned down in the front door of his house, the community was a little afraid.
Meanwhile, police continued to talk with Barbara Rossetti about Sal's last days alive. And she revealed a critical clue. Her husband had been getting strange phone calls late at night. And though Sal had tried to hide his concerns about those conversations from his family, he shared the chilling details with his attorney, Robert Schlein.
He said, I got this phone call, and they said they wanted to meet with him and go for a ride. And this sounded like something out of The Godfather. I said, Sal, under no circumstances will you take a ride with anybody.
Robert Schlein told authorities he believed the calls were connected to the class action lawsuit Sal had brought against several car dealerships in the area. Sal claimed that the company had been cheating salesmen like him out of a portion of their hard-earned commissions.
What Sal contended was that they had systematically inflated the invoice prices on cars to shrink the commission that was to be paid to the salespeople.
Since the commission was based on the amount a customer paid over the dealership's invoice price, the alleged scam allowed the dealership to lower the amount salesmen like Sal made on every car they sold. What was at stake for the dealerships involved in this lawsuit?
They would owe these salesmen for the commissions that they were cheated out of. Punitive damages could have meant millions of dollars.
As the lead plaintiff, Sal had spearheaded the charge to organize his colleagues.
He was actively recruiting people, calling former salesmen, telling them what had happened, encouraging them to join the lawsuit. By the time Sal was murdered, he had recruited 300 car salesmen.
He was a leader. He would mobilize the people that worked with him, that looked up to him. That was something that probably would not have happened without a Sal. He was the kind of a person that you would trust.
Sal had done his best to keep his role in the lawsuit away from his children, but they could sense there was something bothering him.
He wasn't acting like himself. He was impatient and rather irritable.
And Schlein said that in the days leading up to the murder, the pressure on Sal to drop the suit had escalated.
He started getting threatening phone calls that he should not participate in the lawsuit.
Did he have any idea who made those calls?
He didn't. He couldn't identify the voice, was very upset by it.
To your knowledge, did Sal ever consider backing off?
No, he never did. He was resolute about it.
He wasn't fearful. He was very manly. He was a big guy. He was sure of himself.
But investigators and Sal's attorney were now confident that Sal had been murdered to bring an end to his lawsuit.
There's that old saying, if you want to kill the snake, you cut off the head. And he was kind of the ramrod of this lawsuit.
I thought that the reality was clear, that because of his involvement in the lawsuit, that somebody had decided that he should be eliminated.
The theory haunted Sal's family. Could the loving husband, father, and grandfather have been murdered for simply standing up for himself and his co-workers?
Personally think that he either stepped on some toes or he had some information that he wasn't supposed to have.
But who had the most to lose if Sal's case went forward?
The
Police believe finding that answer would also lead them to Sal Rossetti's killer. The San Diego Sheriff's Office believed that the motive behind the murder of Sal Rossetti was greed. Sal had been leading a multi-million dollar class action lawsuit against some very wealthy and powerful business people who were desperate for him to drop the case. Now investigators hope they could follow the money trail right back to a suspect. The murder of Sal Rossetti crushed the class action lawsuit he had been spearheading.
Most of the class members did not want to have anything more to do with it. They were spooked. They were freaked out. They were worried, could that happen to me?
Police carefully began examining who stood to gain the most if the case fell apart. And they quickly focused on the man who owned the car dealership Sal was suing. Aaron Feldman.
Aaron Feldman was a Mexican-born industrialist who came from a very wealthy family. He came to San Diego and bought up several major enterprises, and he had taken over the ownership of the dealership.
And it was that dealership, Center City Ford, where Sal and other salespeople said they had been cheated. Investigators met with Feldman to question him about his possible role in Sal's murder.
He was very cooperative. He didn't want to have a lawyer present when he spoke. He answered all of the questions. He came across as someone without anything to hide.
But the most convincing detail Feldman revealed was the terms under which he purchased the dealership. The paperwork clearly stated that Feldman had no financial liability for lawsuits related to the actions of the dealership's previous owners, Ralph and Lulu Mae Osborne.
He said, look, anything that happened on the Osbornes' watch was their responsibility. If I got sued for any activity that was committed while they were operating the dealership, they were responsible.
The wording of the contract meant that Feldman had very little to lose from Sal's lawsuit.
Did it make it highly unlikely he had anything to do with this plot?
It did.
And after detectives found no other evidence connecting Aaron Feldman to the crime, he was officially cleared as a suspect. Investigators immediately turned their attention to the couple who had sold the dealership to Aaron Feldman, and they discovered that it was Ralph and Lulu Mae Osborne who could have lost millions if Sal's lawsuit was successful.
Ralph Osborne and Lulu Mae Osborne were both very upset about the prospect of a lawsuit. If punitive damages had been awarded, it would have come right out of their pockets.
In fact, shortly before the murder, the Osbornes had been paying off former employees to keep them out of Sal's lawsuit.
The Osbornes had been reaching private settlements with some of these salespeople that he was recruiting.
Police learned that the case had shattered the relationship Sal had had with the Osbornes and their son William, Will Nix, who Sal had been working for at the time the lawsuit was filed.
William Nix was somebody who Sal Rossetti had known for over 20 years in the car business. In fact, they had been close friends.
But when Nix heard about the lawsuit, he severed all personal and professional ties he had to Sal.
William Nix felt that Sal had betrayed him and was causing his family a great deal of trouble.
Investigators meticulously looked for any evidence that might connect the Osbornes or their son to Sal's murder. But they never uncovered anything that advanced the case.
Where did that lead investigators?
To a dead end.
It appeared that Certainly this case wasn't going to be easily solved.
The lack of progress in the investigation was very difficult for Sal's family.
Even though it was pretty obvious to you and your family that this lawsuit had something to do with your father's death, there wasn't an arrest made. How frustrating was that to you?
Frustrating is the understatement.
Did you lose faith that an arrest would ever be made and that justice would be served?
I did. It was like, why is this taking so long?
It was devastating to say that nothing's going to come of this and we're not going to get any justice. That was very disturbing. I thought, how can this be?
More than a year would pass before detectives finally got their next break. A tip from a man who said his conscience had been weighing on him.
He was conflicted, and he just couldn't live with the idea that Sal Rossetti's murder would go unpunished.
And the story he told police shifted an investigation that had been stalled into high gear. One year after Sal Rossetti was ambushed and shot to death in the doorway of his home, investigators finally got a break in the case. A tipster with a guilty conscience came forward, claiming to know who had been behind the brutal murder. Now detectives wondered if the information he provided would be enough to get justice for Sal and his heartbroken family.
The man who approached investigators with a tip was a sales manager who worked at Will Nix Ford. And he claimed that he wasn't the only one who knew that his boss had orchestrated the callous murder-for-hire plot.
He told police, look, there's a lot of talk at the dealership that Will Nix had this done, this open secret.
The tipster revealed that in the weeks leading up to the murder, Will Nix had been furious with Sal over his lawsuit. Then, after Sal's death, he began to openly express how he had solved his problem.
What did he tell people?
He's bragging around the dealership. He doesn't have a problem anymore. The problem's been taken care of.
Why do you think Will Nix would brag to people he knew in public that he had gotten rid of the problem?
Because he's an arrogant guy. He's admitting freely that he had Sal Rossetti killed. It was consistent with his whole persona.
Will Nix had become a local celebrity starring in his own commercials.
Hey, you love you, baby.
He would film commercials at the dealership.
And those he welcomed into his inner circle enjoyed the fringe benefits of his lavish lifestyle.
He ran the dealership. The parties that they used to have were in the body shop of the dealership. Free drinks and free cocaine. Will Nix picked up the tab.
Despite the sales manager's critical tip, investigators quickly became frustrated. None of the dealership's other employees appeared willing to tell police what they knew.
There was a conspiracy of silence, encouraging one another not to talk.
Detectives knew that Nix's employees were terrified of turning against their boss. If he had killed Sal Rossetti, why not them? Assistant U.S. Attorney Larry Burns called in the FBI to help execute a plan to force Nix's conspirators to turn against him.
What was it that the FBI could do that local law enforcement couldn't?
There were certain investigative techniques that we have that they don't have.
In particular, the FBI could legally tap phones and tape conversations between Nix's employees. And with each new recording, more of the deadly plot was revealed.
It involved premeditation. It involved conspiracy. It involved payoffs. It was a murder for hire.
Do you believe that any of the men under Will Nix's influence knew enough to stop Sal's murder?
The answer to that is yes. They knew enough to stop it.
When I saw the extent of conspiracy, I was really, really enraged.
His co-salespeople, his friends, doing this was like a slap in the face.
Prosecutor Larry Burns used the FBI tape recordings to crack the wall of silence. One by one, he subpoenaed Nix's associates to appear in front of a federal grand jury.
When witnesses are called before a grand jury, they are required to answer and answer truthfully. Failure to do so is a crime, and it can land you in jail.
Burns' plan was simple. He would ask each witness what they knew about the murder of Sal Rossetti.
Which was usually, I don't know anything, I haven't said anything.
Burns then played the tape recording that proved the witness was lying, and offered each of them an opportunity to answer the question again.
Were you pretty confident that they would correct their stories and tell you the truth?
Yeah, I'd see a crestfallen expression on their face immediately. It was like, oh my God.
They got me.
Yeah, they got me. You were listening to that?
You're climbing a ladder here, one rung at a time, to try to get to the top.
Investigators listened as Nix's associates revealed the motive behind the deadly plot.
At the forefront of Will Nix's mind was the trouble that this prospective lawsuit was causing his parents.
Ultimately, Nix decided that killing Sal was the only way to solve his so-called problem. He recruited one of the men in the dealership's body shop, 39-year-old Paul Gonzalez, to find a hitman.
He learned that Paul Gonzalez had associates that might be capable of committing a murder.
Paul Gonzalez found somebody who would pull the trigger.
Nix agreed to pay a total of $12,000 for the murder. $8,000 up front, and the rest when the job was done. A money trail, police discovered, backed up the testimony of Nix's associates.
At what point did you finally feel like you had enough evidence to make an arrest?
I now had a number of firsthand accounts under oath of Will Nix admitting that he had set this up.
On May 10th, 1991, FBI agents knocked on the front door of Will Nix's home.
What was Nix's reaction to his arrest?
He immediately invoked his right to remain silent. He didn't want to talk to the FBI agents.
Police had arrested Paul Gonzalez that same day and arranged for the two men to be left alone in the back seat of the police car on their way to the station.
Unbeknownst to Paul Gonzalez and Will Nix, microphones had been placed in the sheriff's car, and Will Nix muttered to Paul Gonzalez, "Keep your mouth shut, just keep your mouth shut."
While that remark seemed incriminating, Nix continued to tell his family that he had no idea why he had been arrested.
"We can't understand what that Paul Gonzalez has to do with all this."
"I don't know either. Mom, I don't know that. That's what I don't understand. What am I even doing here to begin with?"
"You told him that you did that."
"Mom, my whole life, I never talked to Gene Colbert about this case. And I'll swear to God in 100 Bibles."
When FBI agent Art Fitzenmaier led Paul Gonzalez into the interrogation room, he was hoping to get a suspect to provide the details of how Nix had set the disturbing crime into motion.
"Did you think you'd get him to crack?"
"I felt pretty good about it."
At first, Gonzalez tried to deny his role in the crime. But after he failed a polygraph, investigators pressed him to tell them what he knew.
"Our basic target is not you. You know that.
I know that. You guys want to get Will Nix.
It's not a matter of wanting to get Will Nix. We believe that Will Nix set up this guy to be killed."
When detectives confronted Gonzalez with the evidence they had collected, he finally agreed to tell the truth.
Once he started cooperating, it was pretty easy to keep moving him along.
Gonzalez ultimately told authorities that he had hired a Mexican national named Tonto as the triggerman and a second man, 24-year-old Albert Vargas, to assist him. And they were each given partial payment along with a photograph of Sal. The men were originally instructed to kill Sal at the dealership where he had been working. But when the hitmen arrived, they realized that Sal had taken the day off.
Whose decision was it to attack him at home?
They called Will Nix and said, Sal's not there. Sal's not at the dealership. And he immediately said, I know, he's at home. You need to go to his house.
They didn't know him. Albert Vargas had a picture of him. And so they went over to the house. When he came to the door, Albert Vargas had to tell Tonto, that's him, and murdered the man.
After Tonto shot Sal, he and Vargas went back to Will Nix's dealership, where they got the rest of the money they were owed. Nix even gave Paul Gonzalez a reward. The getaway car the killers had used.
It had been repainted. The investigators scraped off the black paint, found the rust-colored paint below.
On November 21st, 1991, Paul Gonzalez and Albert Vargas entered guilty pleas to federal charges of murder for hire. In exchange for their statements, they each received a reduced sentence of 20 years in prison. Investigators never apprehended the man who pulled the trigger. Tonto, whose real name is Jose Miranda, remains a fugitive from justice. When it came time for Will Nix's day in court, the 39-year-old pled not guilty and took the stand in his own defense, blaming everything on Paul Gonzalez.
Was it his defense then that spontaneously some of his co-workers decided to hatch this plot?
He testified that Paul Gonzalez was ambitious, and at one point, after Sal had been murdered, came to Will's office, said, I took care of your problem for you. And in exchange, I want to be the manager of the body shop.
Everything was, I didn't do it. You know, I'm not the guilty one. I thought, how dare you? It was just lies. You know, everything he said was lies.
Did you fear the jury would believe him?
I did fear that, yes.
And no one knew what the outcome would be when the jury returned after just 3.5 hours of deliberation.
Guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree.
What was your reaction when the guilty verdict came down?
I was relieved. I was absolutely relieved.
Sal's wife, Barbara, expressed her gratitude about the outcome to the media.
This was what you wait for. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really happy feeling. I almost forgot what happy felt like.
During her victim's impact statement, Gina Rossetti finally got the chance to speak directly to Will Nix.
I said, you took someone away who meant the world to me. And you knew that. You knew what he meant to me.
Did he react to what you were saying?
No. No, he did not. He's a sociopath.
Was your father's murder, simply put, all about greed?
That's all Will Nix cared about was money. And he had a license plate on his car that said, I want it all. But he was too stupid to know that he already had it all.
Nix was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
What did Nix's conviction mean to your family?
Vindication. The judge told him, you will eat your last meal and you will spend your last night in jail. And that actually made me want to stand up and do a cheer.
Sal's family says not a day goes by when they don't think about him.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Daddy.
He remains a very important part of their lives.
What do you miss most about your dad?
I miss his laughter and his goofy jokes that he would tell. And I miss his big bear hugs, too, that I'd always get from him. Even after all these years, it's still hard. That never goes away.
You don't realize what you do to a family. You wanted my dad dead, but you take more than a person. You know, you wipe out a family.
Investigators believe that Tonto, whose real name is Jose Miranda, is still at large in Mexico. There's an international warrant out for his arrest. If you have any information on his whereabouts, please contact the San Diego Sheriff's Department at sdcrimestoppers.org. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next time when we're back on the case.